Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Right, we are on week three of three, looking at life after death, resurrection, these kinds of things. I'm aware some people have been here for the whole thing, some have missed one, some have, like, no, none of you all missed the same one. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give a really brief overview of everything we've looked at so far. The recordings in the handouts are all available online, so if you go to broadcast.christchurchlondon.org, you'll be able to find them there. But briefly, this is roughly where we've got to. In the first week, we looked at themes of life after death in the Old Testament, and I don't know about you, I find it kind of a little disappointing, not because it was taught badly. Actually, it wasn't taught by me. It was taught by a friend, Andy Shev, and he did brilliantly. But I found it disappointing or confusing because you expect there to be more about life after death in the Old Testament. And actually, we started off by thinking, what is it that we believe about life after death, and writing down some ideas. And then you turn to the Old Testament, and you find there's just not a lot there, to be honest. And we saw that people were not primarily concerned with what happens after death, but rather what you do with your life and how significant that is, and whether you are living in the promises of God here and now in this world. And we saw that there were three L's that Andy said people would have been thinking about and obsessed by. Those L's were, can anyone remember? Land, love, and Liam. Land, love, and life. Okay, not me. Great, land, love, and life. And we said that these would be the three things that people would build their lives around. So they would want to be in the land, in the place that God had given them. Initially, Eden, then the promised land, this place that God wanted them to be in, land. Life, whether they were having a full life, whether they were enjoying the promises of God, and whether they were extending that life beyond them, such that in future generations there will be children carrying on the legacy that they had left. So whether they were having loads of children, filling the earth with people made in the image of God. And then love, whether they were in good relationships with others and ultimately with God. So these were the three things that would have occupied Joe mind, okay, and we imagined that we were an average Joe Jew. What would you have been focused on? Those three things: life, land, and love. But as we went through the Old Testament, we found that slowly people started to have ideas about or ask questions about what might happen beyond life. And we saw when we broke into groups that there were a whole load of different answers to that question: what comes next? And some people said, well, it's a bit like, you know, your soul kind of sleeps and it's a bit sort of like nothingness, and you may just about stir if a king comes down, but that's about it. And other groups said, no, we've got verses that seem to say there's something more, something a little bit more pleasant and glorious, and it talks about a disembodied glory, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore, and these kind of verses. But it's all a bit hazy, it's a bit unclear. And then finally, one of the groups was looking at resurrection and the idea that actually souls wouldn't simply sleep forever or just sort of sit there or even be in a positive state, but actually bodies and souls would be raised up again to life. And we saw that that was really a minority view. Very few people would have held that in the Old Testament times. It's represented in some bits in Isaiah. Daniel 12 is a key passage. Apart from that, it really was a minority view. But then what we saw was that as you get into the New Testament, what were these minority views actually became the majority view. And so we began last week by looking a bit at the Gospels. And I argued really that by the time of Jesus, most people were thinking like the Pharisees did. They were thinking that at some point, all of God's people would be physically raised up from the dead. And there were various questions about how and when that might happen. But they were starting to have the idea that it would happen all together at one sort of cataclysmic moment where God makes all things new. But of course, the thing that shocked that, confused that, was Jesus saying, well, I'm actually going to die, and 3 days later I'm going to come back from the dead. And we saw the disciples were scared, they were angry, they told him he was wrong, they had no idea what was going on. Jesus' own death and resurrection completely changed the way people thought about life after death. And last week we looked at the Gospels, and then primarily the book of Acts. And I argued that now if you were no longer Joe Jew, but you were actually, you know, Joe Christian, you were exploring what the resurrection of Jesus had done for your worldview, you would go on a bit of a journey in terms of rethinking everything you believed. And particularly that would focus around what you believed about Jesus. And I argued last week that people probably would have gone on the kind of journey that says, well, Jesus claimed that he was the Messiah. We know that the Messiah is not meant to die, be defeated by Israel's enemies. The Messiah is meant to defeat Israel's enemies. And yet Jesus died and he came back from the dead. So maybe he truly is the Messiah. And we looked at Romans 1, which says that by the resurrection he was declared to be the Son of God in power. And I argued that Son of God doesn't mean second person of the Trinity. It primarily means the Messiah, the ruler of Israel. So we saw that because of the resurrection, people would have believed that Jesus was the Messiah of Israel, but also that the Messiah of Israel was the world's true Lord and that all nations should bow to him. And thirdly, as you look at the text, particularly in the Old Testament, that talk about this Messiah, you find strange things about the Messiah seemingly sharing the throne of God, and yet God shares his throne with no other. And very quickly, I argued, people were coming to the conclusion that Jesus was therefore not simply Israel's Messiah, the world's true Lord, but also God himself. And that's kind of what we looked at for most of last session. Does that make sense? Does it make sense to those of you who weren't here? Okay, great. That's good. So today, what I want to think about is probably actually why you signed up for this course in the first place. I've made you wait 2 weeks. But we're going to think a little bit about what might happen to us beyond death. And what I want to do is just make some broad comments about God's plan for the world. And then I'm going to get you to do some work. We're going to do some group work and try and piece together what might happen after death. Now, the way we're going to do this is look at a number of passages and try and almost put together a timeline, which is slightly strange because none of the biblical writers do that. So everything we say today will be, in a sense, a best guess from the passages we have available to us. Don't hold me to it. If we get to the pearly gates and you're like, hang on, it didn't happen in exactly the same order you taught us, I'm just going to say, be thankful you're here at all. or you got it wrong in the group work, not me. But we're going to try and piece together... some ideas about what we might be able to expect. And we are going to focus unapologetically, really, on what happens to the believer after death, because we don't have time today to do everything else that we may want to ask. We're going to focus on what the Bible says about the believer after death. Great. So let us think about the broader context. What has God got planned for everything, really, and how do we fit within his great plan? If you were here for the Revelation series, that some of this will be familiar to you. Even if you weren't, actually, it may well be familiar to you, because it's the kind of stuff we talk about a fair amount at Christchurch. Hey, Nathan. So, Genesis chapter 1 and 2. The opening chapters of the Bible lay a biblical foundation for how we view God's creation, what we are meant to think about it, what he thinks about it. We see that God created a perfect world, and at every point he declared that it was good. You've got all the references there in your notes. The pinnacle of his creation was a physical, fleshly, living, breathing being called man. And once man, consisting of both male and female, inhabited this physical creation, we read that God saw all he had made and it was very good. So he made a good world, put man and woman into it, and then declared, "This is very good." Right from the beginning of the Bible, therefore, we see that God is happy about physical things. It's very easy to think that God is primarily concerned with spiritual issues, spiritual things, spiritual concerns. No. At the beginning, God makes a physical world with physical people, and he says, "This is very good." We won't look at the whole story, but I'm sure you're familiar with it. The fall then happens, and we find that every part of God's creation gets broken in some way. In fact, if we were to think of the life, land, and love, we can see it clearly there as well. The life is broken at the fall. How is life damaged at the fall? Give me some ideas. Death. There we go. You got the easiest one. Death. Death happens because of sin, because of the fall. So God's perfect world gets broken because of sin. How is love affected? Enmity between
you and what?
Me and my wife. I'd say between all people, maybe. Okay, yep. No, point taken. Yes, between Adam and Eve. But then there is enmity between all people. There's breakdown of relationship. In fact, only a couple of chapters on, then you get the first murder with Cain and Abel. But also, as you said, between man and God. So it's a kind of a vertical and horizontal breakdown of love relationships. Life, love, land. How is land damaged by the fall?
You now have to work at it,
yep. They're expelled from Eden, yep. From the perfect place where God had put them, yep. So there's a sense of toil. It's going to be harder work now because of what's happened. Also, you're going to get cast out of the place God has got for you. And it seems that decay spreads throughout the world. So this world is not how God intended it. So God loves physical worlds. He loves physical people. But actually what we see around us is not as he intended it. If you skip to the very end of the Bible, Revelation 21, you see God's plan for all time. It says this: "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea." And if you want to know where the fish live, then you've got to listen to our series on Revelation. "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. For the old order of things has passed away.' He who was seated on the throne said, 'I am making everything new.'" So the Bible begins with God making a physical world with physical people in and saying, "This is good. This is very good." And the Bible ends with God recreating the world again to be good. He doesn't screw up the world. He doesn't take us somewhere else. The story ends with him making a good physical place for man and God to dwell again. And Revelation 21 and 22 use very physical language. I mean, just look through the passage. And it draws deeply from Genesis 1 and 2. It speaks of a new heaven and a new earth. There is a city which descends from heaven to earth. I mean, that sounds pretty physical to me. A physical city descends to the earth from where God resides. And so from where God resides, from heaven, to where we reside, earth. This heavenly city comes down. The city is described in very physical terms. It has walls, it has gates, dimensions, jewels, and foundations in chapter 21. And we're invited to enter into this city. We're told that God, who was previously in heaven, will now live with man on the earth. Death, mourning, crying, and pain, those things we just talked about there, the life, love, and land, the way they were damaged, are now got rid of entirely in this new creation. The curse of Genesis 3 is entirely reversed, and this process is described not as an abolition of the physical, not getting rid of all this physical stuff around us, but making it new, making it how it was always meant to be before we messed it up. So we see at the very beginning of the Bible and at the very end of the Bible that God cares about physical things. He cares about a physical world, and he cares about physical people living at harmony with his physical world. And actually, we won't look at all of this because we have covered it in the Revelation series, which you can listen to. But in between, we find again and again and again, the prophets regularly affirm the fact that God is going to do something physical with this world. He's not going to screw it up, get rid of it, and we live somewhere else. So if you look at the prophets, in fact, some of them we looked at in week one, they talk regularly about things like our physical resurrection. The psalmist spoke about the frailty of the earth, but also recognized that God would overcome it by renewing the earth. And here are a couple of passages we looked at week one, but it would help to look at again. Would someone read Isaiah 25, verses 6 to 8? It's there in your notes, I think. Great, thank you. Fantastic. So we have this promise, which I love because it says we're going to drink wine and eat meat. But it's going to be a renewed creation. God's not going to get rid of this world. He's going to renew it. He's going to make it better. He speaks of mountains and feasts. And actually the language, if you think back to the Revelation 21 passage, is very similar about God swallowing up death and wiping away tears from every eye. Chapters 65 and 66 of Isaiah carry on with this same sort of theme. Again, we looked at this briefly, I think, in week one, but it would help to look at it again. Could someone read Isaiah 65, 17 to 25? Great, thank you. Fantastic. So again, this is a brilliant dynamic picture of what God has in store for the world. He's not getting rid of it. He's not done with it. He's renewing it. And what I love about this passage is the way it talks about very physical things. So there's the building of houses. There's the planting of vineyards. There's the working of hands. And it doesn't seem to have negative connotations. This seems to be positive. This is man and creation working well together. Creation will once again experience harmony, and even the animal kingdom will be at peace. So the wolf and the lamb will feed together, not on each other. And there seems to be things working well in harmony together in God's new world. Okay, so this is the broad picture of what God has in store for everything. And so now we're going to look at how you and I fit within that. What is our future within this whole renewed creation? But before I get on to that, any questions? Don't ask me how he's going to do it, but anything that would help you before we move on?
This passage seems to
talk about people dying still. Mm. Yeah, the bit about the one who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed, that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. That's tricky, isn't it? Which is, I'm very glad David has come along to answer that question for us. okay, well, what I think is going on here is, I think Isaiah is not saying that people will die in the new creation, and actually we have a whole load of other passages that suggest that that is the case. In fact, Isaiah himself talks about there being no death on his holy mountain. So I don't think he is saying that, well, there's no death apart from, you know, a couple of bits over here. I think what he's trying to highlight is the injustice of things that happen in the world. So people dying before they are of a ripe age happens in this world. I think he's saying that won't happen in the new world. So he goes on, he talks about people planting vineyards and other people eating their fruit, or he builds houses that other people live in. And I think he's just highlighting a number of the injustices that we see in this world and saying none of those injustices will be in the new world. But I don't think he's saying that some people will die, because that would seem to contradict what he said in chapter 25. Does that kind of make sense? Great. Good question there. Any other questions? Okay, there'll be plenty of other time as we go through. But let's turn to the New Testament then, and in particular 1 Corinthians 15. A number of key texts in the New Testament talk about life after death, talk about resurrection, but I think probably 1 Corinthians 15 is the most significant of these passages. It's significant for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's the earliest account that we have of Jesus' resurrection. So 1 Corinthians 15 was probably written around AD 55, so way before any of the Gospels were actually written down. And so this tells us the first thing that we know in written form about Jesus' own resurrection. And if you read through the whole chapter, which we won't do today, but it's well worth reading, you'll find that it's a whole long, sustained argument where Paul talks about the centrality of the resurrection. And he essentially says, if you do away with the resurrection, you cut off the branch you're sitting on. You do away with all the foundations for Christian hope. He argues that the resurrection is vital for us to understand, and he argues against a number of false understandings of the resurrection. And he says, I think, that if the resurrection is not actually true, then we have no basis for our Christian faith. Let's read just one little bit. Could someone read verses 20 to 28? Again, that's in your notes. Yeah. Thank you.
But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive, but each in his own order. Christ the first fruits, then at his coming those who belong to Christ. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father, after destroying every rule and every authority and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. For God has put all things in subjection under his feet. For when it says all things are put in subjection, it is plain that he is expected to put all things in subjection under him. When all things are subjected to him, then the Son himself will also be subjected to him who put all things in subjection under him. That God may be all in all.
Great, thank you. Could you just repeat that final line? That is thoroughly confusing, isn't it? That final bit particularly. You're like, yeah, I'm tracking with this. I got it. What? We'll get to it in just a moment. But this passage, I think, says a number of things which are really, really interesting and are quite innovative. So bearing in mind what we looked at last week, what Joe Christian would have been thinking about if he was grappling with this sort of stuff, Paul takes us on a whole new step in this passage. He says, first of all, that Christ's resurrection is the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. That's quite a new idea. What do you think? I mean, what does first fruit mean? What does it imply? Sorry?
There's more to come.
There's more to come. Okay. It's not the only fruit. Jesus is the only fruit. No, he's the first fruits of the resurrection. It implies there's more to come. Now, bear in mind all that we've said in the previous weeks. We said that people were expecting one big resurrection for all people at one time. It seems here that actually, because of the resurrection of Jesus, that big resurrection has been split in two. And so Jesus is the first fruits, guaranteeing the rest of the harvest, which is to come. And actually, the way harvesting works, not that I have ever been a farmer, but, you know, I can imagine if someone came in from my fields and said, hey, I've got the first fruit, I've got this, you know, piece of wheat or whatever, I probably wouldn't go, oh, wonderful, what a harvest. I'd say, that's great, bring in the rest. Because the first fruit indicates that there is plenty more to come. And so what Paul has done here is he says Christ's resurrection is the guarantee of an enormous harvest. It's going to be far bigger than just this one thing. But it's like that eschatological resurrection that we talked about last week has been split in two, Christ being the first, many, many, many more to come. He then says, for as by a man came death, by a man has come the resurrection of the dead. So Paul seems to have in mind here the Adam story that we just recapped. He's saying that actually the coming of Christ, the life, death and resurrection of Jesus, has dealt with that fundamental problem that has been in the Bible since page 2. The problem of the fall, which has plagued man forevermore in his relationships with people, with God, with the world, all of this world being now in decay. Jesus has come. And just as one man brought all that about, Jesus, the one man, will demolish all of that. He will get rid of all of that. He puts such enormous significance on the resurrection of Jesus. So then again, he says, Christ, the first fruits. Then at his coming, those who belong to Christ. Again, that's the resurrection being split in two. And what he does in those final verses, you know, the ones that are so hard to read because they don't kind of seem grammatically a little bit strange, is he makes a sort of complex argument, but a profound argument that says not simply we can expect that God probably will renew the world, but actually he has to. God is bound to doing this. And the reason is because of prophecy. And so what he does is he says this: Jesus was raised up from the dead. He was the first fruits. God lifted him to a position of authority. And then what he does is he quotes Psalm 8. He says, God has put all things in subjection under his feet. This is a prophecy about the exalted Jesus. So here he is, he's sitting up there. He's personally defeated death. He now has all things under his feet. But Paul essentially says, but look around, there is still death happening in the world today. And so currently, not everything is under the feet of Jesus. Currently, death is still affecting people today, and so Psalm 8 has not yet been fulfilled. Even though Jesus has experienced power over death, Psalm 8 is yet to be fulfilled. And so Paul is arguing that actually this promise tells us that the resurrection for us has to happen. It has to happen. God is bound to do it because of prophecy. Because he inspired people to say that everything will be under Jesus' feet. Everything is not yet under Jesus' feet. Death is still running around. Jesus will utterly destroy it at the end. Do you see how the logic goes? God said something and he's going to fulfill it. And then he does the weird little bit where he talks about he is accepted, etc., etc. And essentially what he says is this. There is one thing that will not be subjected to Jesus. And that is, verse 27, he who put all things in subjection to Jesus. In other words, the only thing that will not be subject to Jesus is God the Father. Now, he could have said it that simply, but he chose to make it more complex than that. But I think this is a beautiful, beautiful sentiment. At Jesus' second coming, where he comes and he claims us back, he brings in the harvest. We get raised again. I'm skipping ahead a little bit here. When he makes all things new, Jesus will then voluntarily hand over the keys of the kingdom to the Father and subject himself to God so that God might be all in all, it says at the end of that passage. This is where we're heading. God being all in all. All relationships working perfectly, coherently and beautifully under him and his eternal rule. I think that's a beautiful picture. Okay, so now it's your time to do some work. So what can we expect from our own resurrection? As I said at the beginning, what I'm planning to do is this. I'd like us to break into groups, look at particular passages, draw out a few things from them, and then we're going to try and bring them together and have some sort of a timeline of what might happen beyond death, which will require you to be creative and act a little bit, and hopefully it'll make some sense. So what I want to do is I'm going to break you into groups in just a second. I'm going to give each group, and there'll be small groups, possibly pairs or threes. I'll give each of you a passage, and I'd like you to look at that passage and answer a couple of questions. The questions are not in my notes. So the questions are, what does this passage say about life after death? Some of them it will be very little, some of them it will be lots. Some of it you'll be familiar with, some of it you'll go, I don't quite understand that yet. That's fine. Just write it down. What does this passage say about life after death? What will it be like, as far as you can tell? And when might it happen? Again, not all the passages will answer that question, but if there's something in there that answers that question, write it down, and then we'll try and piece it all together. How do we find that? Easy. Andy Tuck is now going to talk us through the entire thing. Okay, some of you difficult, some of you easy. One of the hard things, one of the things that makes this most difficult is that when you look at the passages in isolation, you can sort of think, but I know Liam wants us to get to this answer, but this passage doesn't help us. Or this passage seems to say the opposite, which is slightly confusing. Just as an aside, therefore, if you think this passage says this, but Liam says this, I'd advise you to take the Bible over me, first of all. But I think when we put the passages together, hopefully we will see that some of the questions raised by one group's passage will be answered by another, and so on. Particularly some of you, I've literally taken like 1 Corinthians 15 and given you bits of it, and as we discussed in this group, you know, you were thinking about one question, and actually I hadn't given you the whole of Romans 8, and if I had, it would have answered the question for you and that sort of thing. So as we piece it together, hopefully it will make a bit more sense. Here's what we're going to do. And we're going to see how this goes. I've often done this with groups, and sometimes it's gone really well, and sometimes not so well. It can be a bit messy. If you're listening on the podcast, I have no idea how this is about to go, so this could be the weirdest thing for you to listen to. But hey, it's your fault for not being here. Okay, what we're going to do is this. We are going to try and piece it together and create almost like a timeline of what to expect after death. And what I want is four people who are willing to be actors to act this out for us. So, four volunteers before I, you know, choose to volunteer people. Great. Would you really like to do it? How about the two of you come up and be two of our actors? Wonderful. We need two more actors. Yes, it really did, didn't it? Okay, two more. Yeah, go on then. Andy and Nick. Fantastic. You may bring your notes. Yeah. Oh, good. Well, great. Here we go. Nick, you can be Jesus. No, actually, Andy, you have a beard. You can be Jesus. Yeah. Right, wonderful. You two can be the same person. One of you is the body, one of you is the soul. You can choose. Which would you like to be?
Which one do you want? I don't mind. You can be the soul.
Okay. Right, great. You're the body, you're the soul. Fantastic. So you're Jesus, and you are... you're just a person, okay? So actually, in fact, just a person. If you were to come over here, that would right. be wonderful. Jesus, you can stay there for just a second. Okay, what we're going to do is this. I'm going to try and talk you through the process, and at each point, I want you to... If you feel like you've got something significant that chips into the next step of this timeline, I want you to throw it in there. No guessing, okay? If I say what happens next, don't just guess. You have to be able to justify it from the passage that you have been working on. And not everyone will have read the passages that you have read. So you'll need to be able to say this verse, read it out, so that we can all understand what happens next. And these guys are going to act it out for us stupendously, I'm sure. Okay, so... I'll start the conversation. Also, I'll chip in with a few comments here and there as we go. Probably what would be best is if we keep questions to the end so that we get through the whole process. But then, of course, I'll leave plenty of time for us to ask questions. Great. Okay, so Jesus. Jesus lived. Jesus died on a cross. Jesus was buried. Jesus rose again from the dead. Jesus ascended on high. It's not going to get that tiring, because now you get to sit on a throne forever. So here we go. There we go. Sit on your throne over there. Wonderful. Skip forward a couple of thousand years. Nick invites his friend. I don't know what to call you, because you're a combination entity. Nick invites his friends to an alpha course. They both go on the alpha course. That's all you do on alpha course. Great, okay. But both of you are Christians, so you... look like Christians. This is fascinating, isn't it? Great, bring out all the stereotypes. Wonderful, that's great. Sadly, on the way home from the Alpha course, you guys get hit by a bus, which is really sad. You die. What happens at this point to the body? And you could look a bit more miserable, Nick. You just... Great. What happens at this point to the body and soul? None of you have this in a passage, but, you know, common sense. What happens to the body? It decomposes. It probably gets buried first, doesn't it? Yeah, well, yeah, okay.
That's why you're here, I suppose.
Great. Body is in... Yeah, great. What happens at this point to the spirit or the soul? Floats away with a harp. And justify don't act that out quite yet. Can you justify that from your passage? I think not. Okay. Something happens to the spirit or the soul. Who had Philippians 1? It was you guys, in fact, wasn't it? And not a mention of harps anywhere. But it does say something about what happens to the spirit. Verse 23. What does it say there? Okay, so the spirit goes to be with Christ. Fantastic. You look like you're having a great time. You're sitting there in the ground. Nick is just leaning against a wall, not sure what to do with his life. Okay, wonderful. So now the soul is with Christ. What is this experience like? Any ideas from your passages? Is it a positive experience? Is it a bad experience?
For me to live is Christ and to die is gain.
To die is gain.
Yeah. And then it goes on and says that to depart and to be with Christ is far, far much better.
Okay, so what does that tell us?
It's good.
It's good. Okay, fantastic. That is expert acting. That's wonderful. Okay, so actually there's something about the departing to be with Christ which is actually described as being better than being in the body. I'm sorry it's not because you were a bad body. But okay, great. So this experience is somehow better. Let me just make a couple of comments here, not on any of them. You're welcome to sit up if you would like. Otherwise, I'm just going to tread on you by accident, which won't be pleasant. So let me make a couple of comments on that. The Bible doesn't tell us a great deal about this, which is often known as the intermediate state. There's not a huge amount there. We know that when you die, your spirit goes to be with Christ, but really we're not told a great deal more, except that it is better, but we don't know how it's better, really. I think probably passages like the bit with the thief on the cross is gives us a little bit of a clue. So in Luke chapter 23, one of the criminals says to Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. Paradise is typically a positive word. Actually, it has the kind of the overtones of being like a garden state. That's what the Greek word means. And so it's a kind of a garden. It's a pleasant place. It's refreshing. It's good. But we don't know a great deal more about it. Just to comment on that, actually, Jesus is not saying from now on and forevermore you will dwell in a garden. Actually, we know from the very next passage what happens to Jesus. Yeah, resurrection. Yeah, good. I'm glad you know that. So even the fact that Jesus says, you will go and be with me in paradise. Actually, Jesus doesn't stay there. He then gets raised again from the dead. And so it seems to be that this paradise is a temporary state. And we don't know a huge amount about it. Similarly, John 14, Jesus says, in my Father's house, there are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And many people read that passage as if Jesus is saying, well, I'm going up to heaven to prepare this place and you can come and dwell in heaven forever. But actually, I don't think that's what the passage is saying. And actually, the word translated places or rooms is the Greek word mone, which means a temporary lodging place. So it's a place you would stop if you were on a long journey. You would stop over at a mone, a place, before you continued on your journey. And it seems to be that Jesus is saying there is a place in heaven prepared for us as like this temporary dwelling place. Okay, so there you go. We get towards the end of the world. Let's not worry about the millennium and all the stuff that we covered in the Revelation series. But something is about to happen. What are you most likely to hear? Hopefully it'll sound better than that. A ringtone. Jesus descending on the cloud. Oh, hang on a second. Just got to take this. Yeah, a trumpet call. Okay, can you give me, you obviously don't have your Bible with you, but can you read us the verse?
A cry of command from the voice of an archangel and with the sound of the trumpet of God.
Fantastic. That's 1 Thessalonians 4:16. Anyone else have anything about a trumpet in any of their passages? Yes. Congratulations. Can you read that out for us? Okay, great. Wonderful. So a trumpet. You may blow a trumpet, Andy. Go for it. That's, well, that's debatable. But there we go. Okay. So what does the trumpet symbolise? Christ's return, yes, great. The second coming. It will take some time, so you may move, but you may do it slowly, probably. What happens to our souls at this point? Our souls which have been with Christ, what happens to them? He's got 1 Thessalonians 4.
Oh, that's a...
You guys are going to be busy for a little bit.
Yeah, but we're perhaps a bit confused.
Okay.
God brings some souls, but also...
Okay, right. So, why are you confused by that?
Because there's two stages, actually.
It seems like someone coming this way and also coming this way.
Ah, Okay, so, brilliant. So look at this visual representation. Does this help you to piece together your confusion? So, would you like to describe it? What might happen? Well, you're acting it out brilliantly. So, God, Christ brings the soul with him from where he is, and the body rises again. Does that kind of make sense of your passage? Brilliant. I'm glad there was a point to this acting it out. Wonderful. So the bodies and the soul seem to come together. And where does this happen?
In the sky.
In the sky, okay. And did you just make that up, or did that come from your passage?
That came from the Bible.
Wonderful. Elizabeth, do you happen to have that verse to hand?
Lots of clouds. Well, not lots of, there are clouds.
Okay, so we will meet him in the air. That, yeah.
There is a song.
Which one do you think came first? That is... I won't say that, actually. I will. Okay, I think it's a great song. I think it's a fantastic song. Eschatologically, like, brilliant song. Do you know the song, There Is a Day All Creation's Waiting For? We will meet him in the air, and we will be like him, and we'll see him as he is... Oh, yeah. And I just happened to think, like, I know why they did it. They needed something that rhymed. But at the resurrection of the dead, with the trumpet call, Jesus coming from heaven, I'm unlikely to go, oh, yeah. You know, oh, yeah is what I say when I lose my keys and I remember where I left them. Oh, yeah is not what I will say at the second coming. I will fall down on my face. Apart from that rant over, the song is brilliant. And I made the mistake of saying that to someone once who said, yes, my friend wrote that song. And don't spread that, and I'll cut it out of the podcast. So, we will meet him in the air. Oh, yeah. What happens to our bodies at this point? What happens to our bodies? Anyone have? They will be raised. Yep. What did you have?
They shall be changed.
Okay. Our bodies will be transformed. Actually, I didn't give anyone Philippians chapter 3, did I? But Philippians 3 talks about our bodies being transformed to be like Jesus' own body. So something happens at this body-soul reuniting. That means the body is then transformed to be more like Jesus. Oh, yeah. Indeed. You now get to look like Andy Tucker. Sorry about that. Okay. So what are some of the what are some of the metaphors that some of the passages talk about to describe what this new body will be like?
Ours says a kernel, so we talk about popcorn, how it starts as a kernel and then in the microwave it slowly turns into popcorn.
Yes. That's perfect. I think Paul had exactly microwave popcorn in mind in the first century. But no, okay. So the idea is a kernel that changes into something. Okay, so you start off with a kernel or a seed. You don't expect it to just duplicate more and more seeds. Something grows out of it that is different from but has some kind of source and continuity with the original. Great. Wonderful. And that passage is in... Fantastic. Great. Any other metaphors that some of the passages use? So you guys at the back, 2 Corinthians 5, you had a few of them at the beginning.
It talks about putting on clothes.
Okay.
So it would be called to have more clothes.
Okay. Right, so the idea is that we will not be left naked in this new state, but actually we will be further clothed. Phew. Indeed, although we will have transformed bodies, so maybe it will be fine. But in Greek philosophy, Plato, for example, was very negative about the body, very positive about the spirit. And so Platonic philosophy leads to the idea that one day we'll escape this body and essentially we'll be naked souls, and that's a good thing. Paul says, no, you're not going to be naked, you're going to be further clothed. Something more comes upon you that makes you more clothed than you previously were in this new transformed body. Okay, any other metaphors, or not even metaphors, just phrases? A tent. What did it say about the tent?
We're going to move from having a sort of like tent to being in a building.
Okay, yes.
Being in a building.
And that's 2 Corinthians 5, okay? So, you know, it's now we're in this fleshly tent, you know, just a bit frail and just kind of rubbish. But one day we're going to have a fully stable, solid body that will be more like a building. So something will happen which will transform us from being like this frail, fragile thing into being something more solid, more durable, and fit for life in God's good creation. Okay, a couple of others. I'll just move this along. So it talks about a seed and a plant, a tent and a building. It says that we were previously perishable, now we'll be raised imperishable. And then Paul uses the sort of taunt song against death. He's like, death, where is your sting? You have no power, which I like. You know, you're not stinging anymore, that kind of, you know. Death, you're completely defeated. Our current bodies are, they have dishonor, they'll be raised in glory. They are sown in weakness, they'll be raised in power. Then 1 Corinthians 15 actually says something slightly confusing, which one of your groups picked up on, but I can't quite remember who. It talks about us having natural bodies and spiritual bodies. You guys had that passage. Could you read us that little phrase? I think it's verse 44.
What is sown is perishable, what is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. Thus it is written, the first man Adam became a living being, the last Adam became a life-giving spirit. Mm. But it is not the spiritual that is first, but the natural, and then the spiritual.
Okay. So this passage is slightly confusing because it seems to say that we have natural bodies now and spiritual bodies in the future, which seems to go against everything else that we've just said, like you get a transformed body. And actually the reason for that, and if we had different versions of the Bible, it might be interesting to see how different translations render those words. But the words natural and spiritual are actually confusing translations of two Greek words, psychikon and pneumatikon. Psychikon translated there as natural, pneumatikon being spiritual. And it seems to imply that our future bodies may be spiritual as in non-physical. And that's often what we think of when we think of the word spiritual, don't we? We think of it being non-physical, something that you can't touch or move or hold or anything like that. But actually, if you were to look through, and I haven't given you these references, but feel free to check them out. If you look at 1 Corinthians 2, verses 14 to 15, we're described as a spiritual people. Now, clearly, Paul doesn't mean, hey, you people in the church in Corinth have no bodies. There's something different about them, but he uses that word, pneumatikos. He also says in 1 Corinthians 10, he talks about the people in the desert eating spiritual food. It's not non-material. It's not like Hook, you know, where they're like throwing fake things. And it's physical food they were given, but it was supernatural in origin. It came from God. It was not natural. That's what's meant. Again, I can give you a whole load of references. I think the way those words should be translated, according to the way that Paul uses them in the rest of the letter, is not natural and spiritual as in non-physical, but natural and supernatural. And I think the point is from that whole passage that Paul is saying there is a body that is to come that is not like your natural body. It has some similarities, but actually it's greater than your natural body. It's not non-material, it's hyper-material. It's more physical than previously. It's like changing a tent for a building. It's like changing a kernel for a plant. Your new body is going to be supernatural in origin, and it's going to be durable, and it will be befitting of your eternal existence in the new creation. So if God is renewing all things, as we saw earlier in Isaiah 25 and 65 and Revelation 21 and 22, then actually me taking this tent of a body into God's perfect new creation is just not going to work, because that will last forever and I won't. So Paul is saying that you need something that is supernatural in origin in order to last and stand the test of time in God's new creation. Does that kind of make sense? Great. One other comment, Colossians 1, which again we didn't look at, verse 5, speaks about a hope laid up for you in heaven. And many people have taken this to say that basically what happens after death is that we need to go to heaven to get this hope that is laid up for us. So to use this picture, it would be like us going over here, and now I'm over here, I can enjoy this hope forever. Actually, I don't think that's what the point of that passage is. And Tom Wright uses an illustration. He says, say you came round for lunch or dinner or whatever, and I say, hey, I've got some champagne in the fridge. Why don't we enjoy it? He doesn't expect you, in order to enjoy that champagne, to climb into the fridge and sit there on one of the shelves drinking the champagne. He's saying, I've got something stored up for you in there. Why don't we get it, bring it out, and enjoy it over here? And I think that's a helpful way for understanding this hope laid up for us in heaven. We go to get it when we be with Christ, but then when Christ returns, we get to enjoy it forever in God's newly restored earth. We don't sit and drink champagne in an icebox. Does that help? You see that picture? Great. Okay, so Nick has just done nothing apart from invite his friend to Alpha, but which was very good, obviously, it's saved them. But so Jesus comes back. What happens to Nick? What happens to the person who is still alive?
They're caught up as well.
They're caught up as well. Can you read us the passage? Fantastic. And how do we know that Nick doesn't get caught up in the air before this duality gets caught up in the air? Same passage, verse.
Implicit in our passage earlier on that they will be brought.
Sure. So it says in verse 15, the dead in Christ will rise first. Yeah, so the dead get raised first, and then Nick gets to be raised as well. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up in the air. Fantastic. Does he just get to keep his old body? Do these guys get new buildings of bodies, but Nick remains a tent? Or does something happen to him? Okay. Sure. And again, Philippians 3, a passage I didn't give you, but verse 21 says, we will all be transformed. Our bodies will be made like his bodies. Okay, where do they go from here? What happens to them? Do they go up into the air. They're currently floating, meeting with Jesus, being transformed. What happens to them next? Where do they go? Guys from Romans 8, can you shed any light on that?
Was that when their son was brought?
Yeah.
They become, their own glory. We have the glory that is revealed to us. So there's a sense of glory that they're sons of God.
Yep.
It's not going to be any death or bondage or sin or anything like that.
Sure. And then what does it seem to say about the place where they may dwell?
Rolled back. And then you would restore the earth and creation will be set free from its bondage.
Fantastic. Okay, so it's not the case that Jesus comes from over here, collects the people, takes them back to heaven. Rather, at the second coming, all of creation gets renewed and set free. Some of the stuff we looked at the beginning. And then Jesus brings them to this newly created world. And we spend forever in the new creation. And as we saw earlier, Revelation 21 describes it as this glorious existence where everything is perfect. There is no more sickness or sin or death or crying or mourning anymore. God dwells with man on earth. So to recap the picture here, let's just go through it very, very quickly. Andy, back onto your throne. Okay. Wonderful. You go to an Alpha course. Fantastic. You die. We don't need to add to that. His soul goes to be with Jesus, stays there, fantastic, body decomposes, the body laughs. Okay, trumpet call, wonderful, and Jesus returns with the soul, the body rises from the grave, you get reunited, transformed to be more like Jesus, then Nick, who is still alive, also gets raised up, transformed, where do you go? You go to the air, first of all, yes, where do you then go?
New place.
The new creation. Everything is made brand new. You spend eternity looking very happy in the new creation. Wonderful. Give him a round of applause. You may sit. Okay, that was slightly comical, but actually you see how that did help us when we were with that kind of like, but they're over here and they're over here. How does that work? When you picture it like that, we see something very rough as it is, and I'm sure the real thing will be far more glorious, but we see something of what God has in store for us and this world. There's plenty more that we could have got into, but let me just try and wrap up quickly, and then we'll take some questions. We began the series by asking two questions. What does the word resurrection mean, and what is going to happen to you when you die? And if you were here on week one, we took a moment just to write down some thoughts or answers to those. We're not going to talk about this now, but it would be interesting if you were here. Think, how differently would your answers be to those questions now that you've sort of sat through 3 weeks of us teaching at you? Would you have a different perspective on that, or is it just the same? How different are your answers now? And then how should this affect the way we live? You see, it's easy to think that really this is also distant, this is also far away, that it doesn't have much of a relevance to me here and now. But really it does. It affects the way we think about all sorts of things. Because if you ultimately think that you are in this body and it's a temporary thing, but God doesn't really want you in this body, and eventually he's going to get rid of the world and you're just going to float away somewhere else and leave your body to decay, and that's it for eternity, it makes you think very differently about yourself. It makes you think very differently about the dignity of humanity as a created physical thing. It makes you think very differently about this world. But if you ultimately understand that God has a plan to redeem all physical things and make them perfect, it makes you think completely differently about stuff. Philippians chapter 3, I keep referring to this verse and I've not put it in your notes, but might be worth writing down and looking at. Philippians 3, verses 20 to 21 say this: "But our citizenship is in heaven, and from it, from heaven, we await a Saviour, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body by the power that enables him even to subject all things to himself." And it's very easy to read that passage or to think of that phrase, citizen of heaven, and to think that ultimately it means that I live here now, but really I don't belong here, I belong in heaven. And that's certainly the way I looked at that verse for many years. In fact, one of my first ever sermons, which I'm glad you can no longer download, I basically argued that. I was like, I live here, but really I'm a citizen of someone else, somewhere else. I should be in heaven. That's where I belong, and that's where I'm going to go one day. I don't think that's the point of this passage at all. That's certainly not how citizenship works. Philippi, where this letter was written to, was a Roman colony. So it was an outpost of the Roman Empire, which means it came under the rule of Rome. And many people who lived in Philippi claimed Roman citizenship. They considered themselves to be Roman citizens with particular rights and privileges of being Roman. But Roman citizenship didn't mean that you had the right to retire to Rome, or when you died, you got transported to Rome. That's just not what citizenship meant. It meant that whilst I live here in Philippi, I live under the rule of somewhere else. But I don't expect that I'm ever going to get to go there or move there or be transported there. The very most I would expect is that if I have problems here in Philippi, one day maybe the ruler of Rome would come to my city and sort things out for me. And in the same sort of way, us thinking about ourselves as citizens of heaven doesn't mean that I dwell here and I think, to be honest, I'm not going to be here forever and I don't really care because really I'm longing to get to heaven. That's where I'm going. No, that's not how citizenship works. The point is that we live here under the authority of there. We live here under the rule of heaven. And we expect from that demonstration there and all the passages we've looked at, that one day the ruler of heaven will come to our little outpost, our little colony, and make things right. So the Christian hope is not so much about getting away to somewhere else. It's about living here under the rule of heaven until this place is now is completely made right. That's a completely different way of thinking about citizenship and what we are here to do. Andrew Wilson puts it like this in his book God's Stories, which I think is very helpful. He says, "The church is an outpost of God's empire, a community of people whose passport is stamped heaven, but who continue to live in a foreign land, earth, with the aim of making that foreign land more like home. We take heaven seriously, and we live with different aims and different values from the people around us. We also take our citizenship seriously. So instead of hiding under the bed and waiting for rescue or the rapture, we live in the world with the intention of changing it. We are there to take the empire or the kingdom of God everywhere we go while we wait for the emperor to come." I love that picture. How does that change the way you think about things? Because if you think of yourself as someone who lives under the rule of heaven whilst here on earth, waiting for the day when Jesus will come and restore it, that changes the way we think about the environment. It changes the way we think about our bodies or our communities or physical things around us. It changes the way we think about art and culture. It changes the way we think about architecture and stuff around us. Because this isn't all going to get burnt up. God is going to come back and redeem it. And we're here meant to be extending something of the rule of God while we're here on earth. It changes the way we think about the way we preach the gospel. Do we preach, hey, this world is only temporary, you can get away to somewhere else? Or do we preach a message that we are here to make a difference until the Savior comes to renew it all? It changes the way we think about our worship songs. I joked earlier, but I do think We Will Meet Him in the Air gets it right. It's a brilliant song. But there are plenty of songs we sing that talk about going home somewhere else or escaping this world. It's just not the biblical hope. It changes the way we think about that kind of stuff. It changes the way we think about suffering. It changes the way we think about what happens to our bodies. When things go wrong, do we just say, well, we just deal with it now because one day we won't have bodies that suffer anyway? Or do we say, actually, we're always going to have bodies. It's just they're going to be transformed. It changes the way we think about them, perhaps in subtle ways, perhaps in fairly revolutionary ways. I think it changes the way we think about our mission. It changes the way we build church. It changes the way we talk to people, the way we invest in communities, the way we invest in relationships and things here and now. Because God is not tearing up this world and doing away with it, so we don't have the liberty to either. We wait here as citizens of heaven, working to extend the rule of heaven until he returns. Great. Sorry, I intended to leave more time for questions, but any questions? And if you do need to leave, you're welcome to, but...
Just about the new creation, so new heavens, new earth.
Yeah.
Is it like a redemption of now, or is it a complete throwing away and rebuilding?
Good question, yeah. So the question is it... Does God completely get rid of this world and make a brand new one? Or does he restore this world into the... Yeah. Anyone got any particular thoughts on that?
I mean, Romans 8, redemption of prophets.
Yeah, yeah. So that would make you think it's more likely that he restores out of the old. Yeah, yeah. The tricky thing is we have some passages that seem to say new heavens and new earth, and some seem to say he redeems what we've got, and it's hard to know what it is. I think probably it's more a case that God will take this world that we have now and redeem it and restore it. And I think that for a number of reasons. I think... Partly Romans 8, it talks about the redemption of our bodies. It talks about creation being loosed from the bonds. You read in the prophets, it talks about the trees clapping their hands and that sort of stuff. And you don't get the sort of feeling that trees would clap their hands going, yay, we're being burnt and there are new trees being made. It's more probably the case that, yay, we are being released from this bondage that we're currently in. So I think probably, I mean, that's a slightly humorous joke, but I think probably it's more a case of restoring what's already there. But the primary reason I think that is because of what happened to Jesus. And I think that the resurrection of Jesus is the prototype for what will happen with all the earth. And it was not the case that his body was left in the tomb and he got a new one. It was the case that God took his body and restored it and made it brand new. And I think probably in the same sort of way, he's not going to make a new sort of creation out of nothing. I think he will take what's already there, like he did with Jesus' body, and restore it.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.